Welcome to CFO Radio. I am Lorraine Chilvers, host of the show. CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives for today. I have asked Lee Cantor, executive producer of the show today, to help me out. This is the first radio show that we're producing, and as part of this, I thought that it would be very helpful for our listeners to understand why CFO Radio, why are you doing this, and what is it all about? So thank you very much, Lee, for taking part.
Thank you, Lorraine. I'm so excited. It's going to be a great show, and I'm excited to let the listeners know why you're doing this. So why don't you talk about first what... Tell a little bit about your background. Are you a CFO now? Have you been a CFO?
Yes, currently I serve as CFO for two clients, and they are a small startup. One of them is a small startup company, and one has been well established, actually been in business for about 6-7 years. Theatre Tech Inc. We sell DVD software all over the world, and somewhat of a mom and pop home show. The reason that I got into this, I have 20-some years of background in terms of accounting and finance, served as a CFO, served in various senior executive roles. I've been through very challenging environments, and the CFOs today often are going through a significant amount of challenges. The economic climate is a challenge in itself. CFOs today, the role is ever increasing. And while at the same time there are a lot of awards given out to the CFOs today, they are recognized for the work that they do, there's a gap, I believe, in the opportunities for that CFO to say, this is what I've done in my career, this is what has helped me out, to act as a mentor for that CFO coming behind them.
Right. Now, you're working now somewhat with some mom and pops, but your background is not mom and pops.
That's correct. My background has been Fortune 1000. In fact, very often Fortune 100. I was started out in the traditional path that a CFO goes. In my day, it was Big 8 audit accounting.
So you went from college to...
Yes.
Britain, right?
Yes. I grew up in the UK, and I actually lived for the first 5-6 years of my life in Singapore, so a very international theme. My father was in the Air Force, and we did a lot of traveling. I guess I was number 5 of 5 children,
oh,
so
wow.
By the time I came around, I think he was a little bit fed up with the travel. After college, I did a business studies and accounting and finance degree.
And you liked that. You were that kid who liked accounting.
I'm the geek.
the passion for numbers.
Absolutely. I definitely am that geek. And
so how did you, in your mind, how did you see your career? What was your, how did you imagine it?
Interestingly enough, I turned off to the subjects of geography and history very, very young. I just didn't like that
right.
whole repetitive thing. Where I saw my career was, quite frankly, not looking at roles, not looking at career, but just enjoying the mathematical side of accounting.
So you liked math?
Yeah.
Even as a little girl?
Yeah. I was the geek that came first in math
and
class.
All the math competitions, that was you.
That was me, I'm afraid.
So then, you went to college, and then you got your degree in accounting?
Yes.
Okay, so then you're in accounting, and you're like, okay, now I'm going to work for one of these big firms, right?
Yeah.
They probably recruited you.
You know, they do. It's called the Milk Round in England, and all the big firms came. I'm talking 25 years ago now, but all the firms would come to the universities, and the students, it was fun. We'd actually awkwardly share somebody's jacket, and then you'd run out into the hallway, and somebody else would put your jacket on because you didn't have suits.
Right. And so you were all sharing the same jacket. That's funny. Now, were there a lot of women in accounting there?
You know, that's a very interesting question. Yes, there were, and today, yes, there are. Women tend to go into technical subjects because their intuition and knowledge base can shine through.
Uh-huh. So from college, you got that job, I would imagine. And then were you traveling there as well?
Yes, I was. I was traveling very much. I was away from home. My first day away from home, I remember going to university, and I had one backpack, one suitcase, one duvet, one knife, fork, spoon, literally. It was kind of a world of ones.
And your friend's jacket, right?
And my friend's jacket.
So off you went, and then so you worked for these consulting firms, right?
Actually, I went to one of the big eight accounting firms called Grant Thornton. We were
there was eight back then. Right?
There were eight. Now we're down to four. Right. I guess consolidation, and some would argue we're probably going to be down to three soon.
So then you went there, and then at some point you worked for an individual company, right?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I did. It was a logistics company called Giltz Babulins, and it was the largest logistics and transportation company in Europe. And essentially, the primary customers was IBM, and we shipped product. Inventory was a challenge, and I was actually, funnily enough, the mathematical theme comes through. My mathematics teacher at my exams, her husband worked for the company, and she needed some people. Inventory had got lost over, I guess, a couple of years, and they needed some smart people to come sort out the numbers and the systems.
And then so off you went, and that became your career kind of just
expanded
blossomed,
from
right?
that. Absolutely. I went into internal auditing, and that was a very strong basis for my auditing experience. And I did that with a sole intent to be able to make the leap into the finance function to look at aspiring to that CFO.
So you knew at some point you wanted to be a CFO?
Yes.
Pretty early on, or after seeing him in action?
I guess you tend to say when you go to the Big Eight, the Big Six, the Big Four, that as it is now, we used to call it, we served our time.
Right.
And you tend to be either a career partner that somebody that aspires to be partner, or that isn't for you.
Right.
And I knew after about 2 years that it really wasn't for me. I did my time so that I could get the experience and the managerial level. And yeah, then I took the leap and got out.
Now, did you have any mentors? Because I know you talked about the importance of this show as being a tool to mentor CFOs. Did you have mentors yourself?
Interestingly enough, I did not. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the passion that is coming through for me to put on the CFO radio show, is that I do believe that in my day, very often the father would be a mentor to a son.
Right.
And perhaps in those days, your mother didn't work, or if she did, she didn't have a career as such.
Right.
And so I do feel that it is very important, certainly for the young people of today, to have that mentor. And part of why I'm doing this is to give back.
And to have the CFOs that come on here to be able to tell their story, and maybe the aspiring CFO can learn from their mistakes rather than, you know, making the same mistake.
Absolutely, yes. To give the CFOs today the forum to be able to describe what they do that is challenging, what they do that is perhaps the simpler points of their job, but that it's still got to be done. And then to help the CFOs of tomorrow, you know, that analyst who perhaps has been in work for 2, 3, 4, 5 years and does aspire, but they don't know how to make that leap.
Right. Now, do you find that the young people today, when they are getting involved in maybe their first opportunity or second opportunity, that they're just thrown in and they're kind of in over their head, and there's not a really good training system to help them kind of get up to speed? They got to kind of find their own way.
I agree with what you're saying there, Lee. In the earlier days, perhaps the accounting and finance perspective positions were, you almost did an apprenticeship. You served your time. You went in on a lower salary. You knew that after 2 years you'd go to being a supervisor.
Right.
After so many years you'd get a role to a manager. Very often what you're finding in today's society is that the students that come out, and perhaps on their first day of work, they are more highly technologically with systems advanced than their boss. They may be more technical accounting-wise advanced than their boss, maybe, maybe not. Certainly not from a breadth perspective, but they certainly have that career. And so day one, they don't have that mentorship or leadership from the boss. They're expected to do things faster, quicker, harder.
Right. Now, I think it's kind of ironic that you personally, you had mentioned to me off air that your mom and dad have been together for a long time. Your husband's mom and dad have been together for a long time. And so you come from a pretty stable life. You yourself have been married a long time. And you work with companies that are in this constant state of crisis and chaos. So how is it, maybe you're drawn to that because you're that balancing force, but how has it been when you have kind of a life perspective of kind of calm and you get thrown into these whirlwinds?
That's a very good question, because sometimes when you're thrown in, the people that are putting you in there don't actually know how deep the hole is.
Right.
And very often when you're going in, you don't know how deep the hole is. Yes, certainly I've come from a very stable background, and I'm very thankful for having that. I do go into very complex situations. Sometimes the complexities of the companies that I serve are challenged because they're growing so fast. Growing so fast is almost the same challenge as decline. You may not have the amount of cash to grow as fast as you want. You may not have the team, the people, the skill sets to grow as fast as you want. You may not know how to do what you need to get there. And in the same regard, the crisis of a company that is going through collapse, and I've done a lot of that in my career, is a very challenging one. The employees are very frightened, particularly the finance function in a post-Sarbanes-Oxley world. The employees are wondering whether they're going to be the scapegoat.
Right.
For example, if the sales department gives in numbers that they expect X projections and then they don't come true, you know what?
Someone's going to pay a price.
Someone's going to pay a price. And very candidly, often it isn't the sales team.
Right.
Not initially. The CFO is expected, and the finance function is expected, to maintain accurate and timely information. And the spotlight is there.
Right. And in a company as a whole, the frontline employees probably are thinking that the CFO and that group is kind of getting in their way.
That's very possible. They may be thinking that. The CFO, I tend to talk, and when I do so, I draw a little box in front of my face. CFOs are box-type people. We have rules and regulations to follow. And you know what? If we don't follow them, we plus other executives in the company may be looking at the court system and potential jail time.
Right. How do you help a company when, like, the economy's in crisis, where the economy is the problem more so than your specific business?
Yes. Now, that obviously everyone right now in the U.S. and typically worldwide is going through that. The financial markets have contracted. From an economics perspective, things are very challenged. For publicly held companies, share prices have been depressed. How do you help the little guy? Well, very candidly, the little guy makes up an awful lot of the business life in the U.S. Some statistics say greater than 90% of businesses today are actually run by companies with less than 100 employees.
Right. And that's, people don't realize that. They think that the big companies are what drives things. But when you're working for a big company, how is it that when you have the economy is saying, okay, you know, people lost trillions of dollars of net worth, and the company can't possibly sustain the level of growth they had in the past, yet the Wall Street expectations is that they would keep that going. But the reality is that it's just impossible. And then the company now saying, well, we're not making our numbers, so we got to get rid of people because, you know, we're not making our numbers. And then it becomes a vicious spiral there. And then the employee panics and, you know, it just gets out of control.
It is. And the role of the leader today, I strongly believe one of the challenges is not only attracting but retaining the right people. Some of the very challenged crisis situations that I've been in my career, for example, WorldCom, I was part of that restructure and restatement team. The individuals there that were employees didn't have a direct impact on the fraud, the bankruptcy, and so forth. Numbers were handed to them, and there were some very challenging circumstances. Yet I remember the key element of needing to motivate your financial and accounting staff when they may personally have just lost $500,000 or $1 million of their 401k, and there was a lot of pressure in that environment to have your 401k be in company stock.
Right.
Very challenging situation. There really is no answer for the economic situation in regards to even the mom and pop store that is out there. The internet gives us open access to a world environment. Small companies today can ship product all over the world relatively easily.
And they can be nimble. They can make moves where the big companies, they're a little slower to really jump on trends and stuff.
That's very true. And there's often a balance of the small company not knowing all of the rules and regulations and sometimes blindly shipping product in a country that perhaps they shouldn't.
Right.
Not understanding all the rules, perhaps if it's a technology company, not understanding that there are certain regulations that need to be upheld to transport and sell that software abroad. They may be caught in the lack of knowledge that blindly they go out and sell. But in the same regard, there are, through the internet, very easy ways, and through your chambers of commerce and other U.S. departments, the ability to learn about those regulations as it impacts your business.
Now, can you speak about that maybe with that theater tech? Do you have an example where you've been able to kind of help them along those lines?
Yeah, Theater Tech is a DVD software company. It's been in existence for about 7-8 years, and the company sells DVD high-end output for DVDs, if you will, if an individual wants to have a very high-end output in their house.
Right, like a home theater.
A home theater, absolutely.
The
first challenge that we had in that company was software licensing, making sure that we had all the right licenses and so forth. You've got to make sure that the Hollywood set have got their right payments and so forth. The second challenge for us was, because it was a software business and because it was over the internet, how do you have individuals pay?
Right.
And the internet, there are many very good payment solutions that you can use for that. And then the challenge there becomes, for example, 3-4 years ago with the European Union, there were some very strong challenges into the software department as to whether value-added tax or VAT should be charged even to U.S. entities. And so the individual that may be that small entrepreneur and business does need to be very concerned about that.
Right, and that's something that it wouldn't even be in their radar. Like if you're an American company, you wouldn't even think like of how it's going to impact you in different countries, their taxes and their own individual situations. So,
yeah.
So a lot of times that's when somebody in your role comes in and is able to help them. Now, what about the big companies? How do you see the big companies adjusting now through all this? And with your work with them, it's a different... How do you jump between these big companies and little companies, where the big companies have certain needs and the little companies have other needs?
Very true, yes. There are often very different needs. Financing needs are very different. Capital structures are very different. Certainly the ability for a large company to go and do what they want to, they will have support more likely from shareholders. They will have more capability to go get that financing that is tight. To answer your question in terms of how I transition from that large to small companies, there's a lot of consistency in terms of the control that need to be established, the systems that need to be established for accounting and finance, the benefits that can be achieved through doing the right thing early on and setting the right process, making sure that your accounting and finance function is run well and properly. There are streams of similarities between that large company that need to be brought to the small entity.
Right. Is that the gap, you think?
I do believe so. That is the gap. With working with small to medium size companies, very often an individual might start up a company and they perhaps are a creator or a chemist. They have an idea, maybe a marketing idea or a software idea. They launch it and they may achieve $1, $2, $3 million of revenue. The challenge for them may be to sustain beyond $10 million or $20 million. And then there may be another jump perhaps when they reach $100 or $200 million, where perhaps they are challenged in that they don't have the right people on board. They need to make this decision if they were the owner or the founder. Am I the CEO of tomorrow? Leadership is a very strong challenge for that growing company.
Right. Now, when you're working with those growing companies, how do you advise them in the sense that some founders especially, their business is more of a lifestyle business where they're just happy making money and doing what they're doing, and they don't want to be the biggest company. They just want to be a great company. But in your head, you're like, well, this is something that could scale. This is something that can be huge. How do you kind of help them through that?
I learn and have learned over my time that you really need to adapt to the company and the people that you're speaking to. Some people are open to that and some people are not, and that's a very personal situation. But in that regard, I surround myself with other advisors that are very good and they know their topic. For example, I'm not an attorney. I wouldn't pretend to be able to give out legal advice. A small company should surround themselves with advisors that can give them these kinds of advice, whether it be in marketing or legal or accounting and finance or other elements of growing their business. Maybe they need someone to help with recruiting and get the right leadership team. And in gaining these access to these experts, being able to pay them maybe on an hourly way or sometime some basis like that, they can get the expertise so that they can help them become that large company should they want to.
Now, in the large companies, they never want to be they always want to look towards growth, right? You don't find them saying, oh, let's stay here. We're good at this size, right? They're always got to keep the foot on the gas, don't they?
One would think that, but there are a lot of companies, for example, in Atlanta, Georgia Pacific went through a process where they went away from being the large publicly held company after an acquisition of Koch Industries. They actually went to being private again. They didn't want the focus of the public reporting. That is pretty rare, particularly based on the size of the companies. But there are companies that every company should look at that large size as to whether the business units are profitable, whether they are gaining value from that extra revenue stream, whether the product or service that is being sold is a good balance for the product suite that they have. And it is very common for those larger companies to shed those business units and to make sure that they keep staying with the core value.
Now, do you find that to be cyclical, where there's periods of time where companies are buying up lots and lots of companies and then other periods of time when they're shedding these companies?
Yes, I would say so. When I was in my early days doing economics and accounting and mathematics, we would learn about the large is beautiful, big is beautiful, and there was a lot of consolidation taking place.
They're like economies of scale. Yeah, we'll be more efficient. And then they do this, and then they're like, it's not a good fit. The cultures don't match, and then they get rid of them.
And absolutely, culture match and lack of match is a very key element to making sure that those forecasts and projections of economies of scale come true. I've been involved in a lot of mergers and acquisitions for Fortune 100 companies, acquiring either small local entities or acquiring quite large ones. I've been involved in some, for example, SBC and Bell South merger here in the Southeast. That was quite substantial. And you find very similar elements, no matter what the size of the company is. They need to bring together the corporations, which is people. Companies are people. When you get to the heart of the matter, companies are people.
And where does culture fit on that balance sheet?
That's the challenge. And part of the challenge in the accounting and finance function is how do you value that company and the elements of goodwill and that, if you will, non-quantifiable or hard to quantify intangible asset.
Right.
But to your point, yes, a company is people. If you don't get the people aspect of it right, it really doesn't matter what you're doing in the finance and accounting function. Companies are people. Companies are emotional. Companies have culture. And helping companies to grow and realize what their corporate culture is does have a trickle-down effect to the accounting and finance function. Part of the bankruptcies and the frauds that I've been involved in have led me to very quickly learn that company culture is most definitely from the top. If the individuals that are leading that company at the top are all about honesty and ethics and doing the right thing, that will trickle down. One of the challenges when you go to business school to learn about ethics, you're given case studies such as if your top salesperson is found to have done something or made a sale or had some success in the business through something that was perhaps data that was collected inappropriately or something that was a little bit underhand, do you get rid of that person? And the answer has to be for the finance function and for leading the company in the right way, absolutely you must.
Right.
You've got to do the right thing.
Now, people and culture, that's part of why you're doing this show, right? You want to kind of humanize the people.
Yes.
Who are some of the guests that you'd like to have on or you plan to have on?
who I'd like to have on. And
Your dream guest.
I would love the CFO of Coca-Cola to be on here, Gary Fayette. I'd love to have him here.
Yeah, so you want to get that level of... But also you want to get people in. You mentioned that you work with Fortune 100 to Fortune 1000.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be that size, right?
No, absolutely. We are going through a process, and I don't want to share too much about some of our upcoming guests. We'll be putting out press releases for that. But we want to look at the small growing entrepreneur as well. And that mid-sized company that is going through the challenge, maybe they're at 200-300 million and they can't get to a billion, that size company as well, because the different stages of a life cycle of a company, learning those key elements of what is the struggle for that company will help other finance people be able to recognize it when they face it and to be able to work through it.
Are there any challenges you see them facing today?
The big challenge that I see for the small entrepreneur is financing. Whereas 3, 5, and 10 years ago, and further back, it was pretty easy to be able to go and get a loan. Okay, you needed to negotiate guarantees. You needed to be able to negotiate interest rates. But and there are venture capital firms and angel firms out funds out there that would lend. All of those markets have tightened up so closely that the entrepreneur of today is really struggling to be able to get the first seed money to put the business on the ground.
Yeah, and that I guess that hurts the economy as a whole because there's less businesses being created to create the jobs that need to be created.
Absolutely, but in the same regard, Lee, it gives the opportunity to the large Fortune 1000s and the behemoth companies, the multinationals, to be able to take the opportunity to ramp up their M&A activities, have their financial analysts go look at these small entities, and perhaps prepay some of the revenue opportunities, help them with their R&D costs, help funding them with potentially the opportunity to gain more of the market share through that business, to bring in value and maybe even buy some equity.
Now, are you seeing that kind of acquisition now where the strong is buying the weak at this point?
I've seen that through my career. In the last 3-5 years, that has died down, but I'm seeing a little bit of that, I would say, on the periphery. It's the murmurings are out there.
And that would be, I would think, positive for the economy.
Very much so.
Right. Now, do you see any missteps that these some big companies and small companies make?
Yes, it never ceases to amaze me, the companies that I go into, whether they are small, medium, or large. They very often forget about the basics, and I came up with a background of very strong SEC reporting, very strong focus on accounting controls.
You're a rule follower.
I'm a rule follower, very much so. But in the accounting and finance function, when you're helping particularly small companies, entrepreneurs almost have an antagonistic feeling towards rules. They didn't come up in a rules-based environment, and that doesn't work for them. But yet the controls that you need in a finance function, you only need the entrepreneur to have one finance person walk away with the contents of the bank account before they actually recognize, oh, yeah, I needed to have a signature
control.
That would
have been a good idea, right?
That would have been a good idea.
Now, your company is called Delaney. You want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's a personal choice by you.
Yeah, sure. Delaney Consulting LLC, I started it up 18 months ago. We serve companies, Fortune 1000 and small entrepreneurs and businesses alike, providing them CFOs, controllers. We do that whether they need the assistance on more of an interim or consulting basis. And at the same time, we have a part of our business that is focused on retained placement. So if the company needs that CFO or controller permanently, we can place that person.
And Delaney, the name?
Delaney, the name. Yes, there's another female theme that is named in regard for my mother. It is her maiden name. And interestingly enough, my marketing officer and I sat back several months ago and had not realized that our first press release by accident or by coincidence went out on my mother's birthday.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. Now, part of CFO Radio is the tradition of asking our guests their CFO tip of the month. Do you have a tip of the month for us?
I do have a tip, and that would be focus on sales, sales, and sales. And when you're done on that, focus on sales and sales and make sure it comes in as cash. But what I would actually like to do is to be a little bit more generic in this regard. The focus of CFO Radio is to have CFOs and financial experts and executives come in and talk. And through this, I'm hoping that we will be able to have a very, very strong element of tips of the month to be able to educate our readers. And I'm actually looking forward to hearing all the different CFO tips, because in the last 6 months speaking about the radio show, I've been quite surprised as to who has said what tip.
That's good. Well, thank you, Lorraine. Thanks for being a guest today. And why don't you thank our sponsor and tell us what we can expect in the future?
Absolutely. I would like to thank our contributors, CFO.com. Through the program, we will be airing newsreel from them, so thank you to them. And also to the Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses that we serve today. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. Thank you very much to you, Lee Cantor, for taking out the time to be the producer today and to interview me. And this and other thought leadership about today's CFO is available right from your computer at www.cforadio.com. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off.